Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Veterinary Advice, Animal News and Views, the place for pets and their people who love them.
Aww, he's so soft.
Come here, boy.
Here is your host, practicing veterinarian, Veterinary News Network reporter, and host of the popular YouTube show, The Web DVM, Dr. Roger Welton.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Veterinary Advice, Animal News and Views. I'm your host, Roger Welton, practicing veterinarian. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. Tonight's show is a day in the life of a practicing veterinarian. For those of you who choose not to read my blog and tune in by podcast or watch the video, one of the things I wrote about earlier today is that we tend to have preconceived notions of what various careers are like. There's things that we see on TV, there's things that we hear, there's things that we read, and of course there's things that we dream up in our own minds as far as exactly what a certain profession is like, and veterinary medicine tends to be no different. Can't tell you how often I'm out and we'll just get talking and I'll meet people and they'll ask me what I do for a living. I tell them veterinarian. Suddenly, you know, it tends to pique a lot of interest and certainly it's a good conversational piece, but I always find it a bit amusing when people sort of offer their own kind of input as to what they think it must be like. And, you know, it can vary anything from some people idealize it, like think that I live in a James Herriot novel, which, you know, I do love James Herriot. He's an inspiration to many an aspiring veterinarian, but the reality of being a veterinarian is a bit different than his short stories. And, of course, you know, you see things on TV like emergency vets, and while it can be like that sometimes, it's, you know, not quite that glamorous. So there's a whole range of things that people, I guess, attribute to the veterinary profession. And so I've gotten a lot of feedback as to this show and perhaps offering some insight as to what it's really like. And I certainly like to listen to listener, reader, and viewer feedback, because without you guys, I don't have a show. And certainly I like to know what it is you want to hear about. And this is one of those things. A lot of our listeners, I'm really happy to say and excited to say, are actually students that are studying to either be veterinary technicians or veterinarians. And I just find it so flattering that they tune into this show to get an idea about the profession and learn as much as they can. Students are very exciting to work with because they are like sponges. They are so eager and excited to learn and just so willing to just sponge up as much information as they possibly can. So it's very exciting for me to know that there's people like that, forming a very large contingent of my overall listenership, viewership, readership. And, I thank you all for that. So I'm going to give a little back today, and I'd like to tell you a bit what it's like. And so I'm just going to kind of break down my day. And while I don't represent every veterinarian out there, I will say that having worked in many a different clinic, having been in different paradigms and different practice philosophies, we all tend to share some similarities. We're all a bit similar. I'm very fortunate to have a doctor recently sign on to work full-time in my practice. Dr. Fogelberg is his name, and he came over from another practice he was at for 15 years. Different practice and different way of doing things, but in the end, you know, a lot of similarities. And so when we came together to form a new team, we kind of had a meet in the middle as far as what our expectations were and how we want to practice medicine. But in the end, it wasn't really too different. And so, you know, again, we never worked together before, and here we find that there's just some general tendencies we all have, and certainly I'm no different. So we do have two email questions tonight. I'd like to remind everybody this is also a live call-in show. Now, I do know that the live podcast may be interrupted, so I may only be available by archive. I know Blog Talk Radio, which is the service that I use to come to you live streaming, is having some outages tonight. So while it won't affect my archive, it may affect the live stream. But nonetheless, let me give you our live call-in number, 877-878-1435, 877-878-1435. And by all means, if you get that number and you'd like to call in, we'd like to hear from you. You can also contact us by email. And our email is comments@web-dvm.net, comments@web-dvm.net, excuse me. web-dvm.net is the host site for my blog, and so hence my email address, comments@web-dvm.net. Tonight, before we jump into our topic this evening, I'd like to address our first of two email questions, and one of them is from Christine from Ontario, Canada, one of my many Canadian listeners. I love to tell my friends and colleagues here in America that I'm actually quite popular in Canada, and I do appreciate all of you tuning in. Christine has a food allergic dog she's asking me about, and this is a really good question. My dog is horrifically food allergic. If fed anything he's allergic to, he gets constant skin breakouts. Hypoallergenic diets work really well for him, but only for about a year, then he starts breaking out again. He's been on ZD Ultra, venison and potato, rabbit and green peas, and now currently on duck and sweet potato. Now that this latest diet has run its course, do you have any idea which diet I can go to next? My vet does not carry any other diets. My dog is only 4 years old, and I feel like if I have not already run out of options, I inevitably will. Please help. I've seen this actually a couple of times before, so let's break down food allergy a little bit in dogs. Food allergy can manifest in one of two ways. It can manifest in the skin, causing chronic allergic skin disease, hair loss, dermatitis, chronic ear infections, things of that nature. It could also manifest in the bowel and cause diarrhea, vomiting, or a combination of the two, malabsorptive disease, malnutrition. In Christine's dog's case, it's manifesting in the skin. Now, I will tell you that food allergy as a cause for skin disease is a bit overplayed because it does exist out there, and certainly I think it's pretty conclusive in Christine's dog's case. Because it exists out there, though, I people latch on to that and they think it's the source of all skin allergies. In fact, it's really not. Realistically, only 10% of dogs are food allergic. I'm sorry, 10% of skin allergic dogs are showing signs of allergic skin disease. 10% of those we can strictly attribute to food. In about 30% of skin allergy cases, we find that there's a food component, but overwhelmingly, there's usually an environmental cause. Grasses, molds, various organic matter, and you know, so I'd like everybody to take that away from here. Don't overplay the food allergy thing. Certainly, we want to do food trials. In Christine's dog case, clearly this is a food allergic dog, and I have seen a couple of cases like this where you have a wonderful result with a hypoallergenic diet. And when I'm talking hypoallergenic diet, I'm talking about prescription grade hypoallergenic diets, because a lot of people will try to do their own hypoallergenic diets. They'll read labels, you know, and go the whole quote-unquote holistic grain-free, corn-free, all that jazz diet. And in the end, they're not really getting to the crux of the matter. Our most common food allergies are actually not grains and certainly not corn. Corn is like 27 to 32 on the food allergy list, depending on which study you look at. Wheat is a grain that is about number 7 or 8 on the allergy list, so it's up there, and certainly, you know, that's something we want to limit or eliminate when we're talking hypoallergenic diets. But beef number 1, chicken number 2, you know, and so a lot of these quote unquote holistic diets, and I say quote unquote because it's just a ridiculous terminology. There's actually no criteria that defines what a holistic diet is. They just throw that on there, and it sounds wonderful, and people will buy it. But, you know, they go grain-free, corn-free, but it's a beef-based diet, and so your dog's still going to react to it if he is truly food allergic. Your cat's going to react to it if he's indeed food allergic. So, you know, not a good choice. If it's chicken-based, not good. Turkey, close enough to chicken, probably highly reactive. So, folks, you want a diet to fit the criteria of hypoallergenic in the sense that you're offering a novel protein source. Novel protein source, meaning a protein source the dog has never been exposed to, has to be something they've never been exposed to. And then the other thing is there can't be any byproduct of the animal they're reacting to. So, you know, if there's milk products from the cow and the patient is beef allergic, well, you know, you could have a venison-based diet and throw milk extract in there or milk, whatever, dehydrated milk products, which is very common to do in diets, and your dog's still going to react. So, you know, so much malarkey out there. You don't want to be messing around with having to read labels and deduce this stuff for yourself. Go with a prescription hypoallergenic diet. So ZD Ultra is a good one. Venison and potato, I'm guessing, is probably the Royal Canin product, as is rabbit and green peas. Duck and sweet potato, not sure which one that is. There's a few different brands that make a duck and sweet potato. So they've run their course, so where do you go next? Well, just because your vet doesn't have it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I know Eukanuba makes a kangaroo-based diet, so you can research that. If you go down to any local PetSmart, because they have the Banfield hospitals, the veterinary hospitals, the sort of those generic hospitals, within the PetSmart, they carry everything. And I know the PetSmart down the road for me, for when I have patients that need diets that I don't necessarily carry, I'll just write my client a prescription and they can take it right down to PetSmart. So I would go to a kangaroo-based diet, you know, should be tasty. I know it sounds awful eating kangaroos, but, you know, in Australia, they're really a little more than deer and they're as plentiful. And certainly if you fed venison, you know, you shouldn't feel much different about feeding your dog kangaroo. They're eaten in Australia pretty much as commonly as we're eating deer here. But that's a good choice for you. There is also a soy-based diet that I believe Royal Canin has. Surprise, your vet hasn't been able to get access to that if he's carrying Royal Canin products. Maybe you can ask him if he can look into the soy-based one. And then we can get really funky down the road, like pheasant and things of that nature. So there's options for your dog down the road, and we can at least buy you another year with the kangaroo, and then a year after that we can probably buy you with the soy. So we got 2 years covered right there. That brings us to 6 years of age. You know, and you just have to continue to just find whatever's out there, and certainly you're always welcome to call back here if you need to. So in the end, let's say in the unlikely event, I'm saying unlikely because I don't think it'll happen, but in the unlikely event you run out of diets, well, they're, you know, not all is lost, because rather than feed hypoallergenic food, you can actually instead put them on a medication like Atopica, which is very safe, suppresses signs of allergies, and you could feed them whatever you want. Of course, Atopica, depending on the size of the dog, can be expensive, but, you know, very safe options. So there are options, and, you know, not all is lost if the dietary option doesn't necessarily prove to be as consistent and effective as it is at this point in time. So good luck, Christine, and thank you for writing into us all the way from Ontario, Canada. So let's talk about our episode this evening. I'm going to break it down for you. And as I said, you know, I'm going to give this to you as objectively as possible. I'm not going to glorify it. I'm going to tell you exactly, you know, what it is. I'm actually working tomorrow morning, and my day is going to be just like this. So I just want to tell you all about that. And then Erica from Lake Mary, Florida, sent us an email question, and we'll get to that as our last item of business. So 8:45 a.m. My hospital actually opens at 7:30, but I'm not there till 8:45 because there's a lot that needs to be done before the doctor gets there. Animals need to be let out. In-house patients need to be treated. So basically, rounds is the time when a lot of that stuff is in motion. Basically, the technicians have been doing primarily working with the drop-off morning surgery patients. So morning drop-off for surgery between 7:30 and 8 o'clock. And what they're doing is doing their own physical examination. They're running any testing that we want preoperatively. There could be maybe an EKG we may want to just check the electrical impulse of the heart. We may want to take a chest x-ray. We may want to run blood work. We may want to do all of the above. So the technician runs through the gamut of that and has that all prepared, you know, for when I come in. And that's one thing the technicians are doing. The other thing they're doing is going through and examining and taking all the vital statistics for our in-hospital patients. So patients that are hospitalized, that are under treatment, they're going to do all those morning treatments. They're going to feed whoever's supposed to be fed. They're going to let them out, and they're going to give them a full physical and check their vital statistics. They're going to record that and have all that ready for me to come in. They're also going to check the patient's demeanor, pain levels, level of pain. There's some things that I'll give them parameters. So if it's a painful condition that the animal is being hospitalized for, we gauge pain in part by demeanor, but because cats and dogs can't say ouch, especially cats can be very stoic about their pain, we measure their heart rate. And there are certain heart rate parameters where I'll say, just go ahead and give them the injection of morphine or Buprodex or whatever pain relief we're going to be using. So the technician has some discretion in where things are going based on parameters that I've set forth in the record. So they get all that done. And while I'm dropping off my kid at preschool, they're getting all that done. And I show up at 8:45 and go over all of these things with the technicians. For the in-hospital patients, what I'm going to do is either recommend discharge or I'm going to recommend further hospitalization. I may keep treatment the same. I may tweak things based on what the technician has reported to me. I may decide to change course altogether, run some new diagnostics, perhaps repeat blood work, things of that nature. I will usually give the patient my own physical over and above what the technician did, not to be redundant, but I just, you know, I really feel that as many physicals as the patient can get, as many perspectives as the patient can get, the better for the patient. So I'm typically going to look them over. Regarding the surgical cases that we're going to do surgery on, I go over all the findings with the technician. We triage the most urgent cases that we should be doing first and which ones we should be doing last in terms of stability, need, and whatnot, special owner considerations. They may need to pick up at lunchtime or something like that. And we make our decision as to the surgical schedule. Any special considerations, special pre-medication protocols, special injections I want them to have, a special fluid protocol, putting in IV catheters, all that is done based on what I tell the technician. So that's morning rounds. Very important, very, very, very important part of the day. And as you know, it can take anywhere, depending on our caseload, from 15 minutes to as long as 45 minutes to an hour to do rounds. So we get to like 9 to 9:30 a.m. And, you know, at this point of the day, we're ready to move forward with our surgery, dentistry, and other procedures that may be dropped off. And one of the things that, you know, is fairly common theme in general practices, because most of us are not 24-hour facilities. We have emergency and critical care centers that we can refer to after hours. So as a result of that, you know, basically we're trying to knock out our surgeries in the morning for the most part, because if we're open till 5, well, we want to have as much of a day as we can monitoring the patients postoperatively while we're fully staffed in case anything needs to be changed, protocols need to be amended, patients need to be given additional pain management, whatever. A lot of our procedures are elective, so the patients, most of them will go home that afternoon. And a lot of the patients, or pretty much all of them, if they're going to be sedated or put under general anesthesia, we're going to have them fasted from the night before, no food, no breakfast before dropping them off, so they can be quite hungry. And I think it's kind of mean to keep them hungry till the afternoon. So we want to knock out our surgeries for the most part in the morning. And so we're going to do all those procedures. I also do quite a bit of acupuncture and therapy laser. For those of you who have tuned into my alternative medicine lectures, I'm the doctor who is the alternative medicine guy in my practice. And so I'm involved in a lot of acupuncture cases. So I'll do those during this time as well. And, you know, all that stuff is getting done in the morning. So now comes, you know, somewhere between noon and 1:30. We call this our quote-unquote lunch hour because it's never a set hour. It's not always an hour. It really depends on how surgery goes and what kind of emergencies may come through the door. But lunch, for the most part, yes, occasionally I can reserve it for a peaceful meal. Maybe have time to call my wife, see how the kids are doing, that sort of thing. But usually I'm stuffing my face as I'm doing my callbacks. Callbacks are the veterinarian's bane. They're a very important part of what we do, but you know, very time consuming. And so we're going to get to those typically by at lunchtime. What are the callbacks? They are clients that are calling for specific questions they have in their pet's health, questions that are related to a treatment course that you've recommended, questions regarding lab results perhaps. If I've run lab results, those results will end up in my inbox, and so I'm going to want to call and report those results because, you know, people want to get that that information as quickly as possible. And from a medical standpoint, we want to get out results as quickly as possible. So while I'm eating my sandwich, I'm calling people back, hopefully not talking with my mouth full too much. And that's what I'm doing with a lot of my lunch hour. Now, as far as maybe being a bit unique to me, because I am a practice owner, I have the distinction of also sometimes having my callbacks involve calling a disgruntled client, somebody who's not too pleased with whatever has happened in the hospital they're perceiving as not good. Usually my office manager will deal with those, but there are some cases where it's a particularly particular client that I've been with for a very, very long time and know them very well, and I'm surprised that they're disgruntled, want to talk to them personally, or if they're just not satisfied to talk to the office manager, I will have that conversation. As a practice owner, that is something that I have to do. Lastly, when in addition to callbacks, I always have to do callbacks at lunchtime, but lastly, pharmaceutical reps commonly want to talk to you about new products their companies have. So new product lines that they're putting out, they want to educate us about them. Sometimes there's existing products that there is new research we need to hear about in terms of safety, in terms of handling it, in terms of efficacy. There might be a new use for a particular medication. So the pharmaceutical reps will try to get us over lunchtime to educate the staff. And since they will typically bring us lunch during these times, they're called a lunch and learn. So lunch and learns are a common thing we'll do also maybe once a month. Some pharmaceutical will come in and we'll do a lunch and learn and hear about whatever new products are out there for a given pharmaceutical. Those actually can be quite pleasant because sometimes, you know, it could be the next best thing. The other day we had Elanco come in. Elanco makes the products Comfortis and Trifexis, which have really just been such a boon to veterinary medicine in treating our dogs and cats for pests. So we always want to learn as much as we can. That's one way we can do it. So that's our lunch hour. So now this brings us to about 2:30, and this is when appointments start. So appointments, regularly scheduled appointments, we're going to see. Those are going to be our yearlies. So we're going to update vaccines, do stool analysis. We're going to do heartworm screening, and you know we have our regular visits that are pre-scheduled in that way. Sometimes if an animal's not too sick or feeling too terrible, they're just a little off, the owners will make an appointment and, you know, we'll see a regularly scheduled appointment. But one of the things that sets my hospital apart from other hospitals, we do see emergency and critical care cases. I don't like to make people wait. If an animal is sick, they're in pain, we tell them to come right down. We normally have two doctors on staff. We can handle it. And, you know, emergencies can be exciting and also can be life-saving for the pets. And, you know, again, we don't like to leave anybody hurting, so we're going to see quite a few of those. And a lot of general practices won't see emergencies. They'll pull the old human medicine thing and they'll say, oh, okay, your dog is hacking and can't breathe and is collapsing. All right, well, I think we can get him in here in about 2.5 weeks. How's that sound? You know, that's the ridiculousness we see in human medicine. There are some ridiculous veterinary hospitals out there. We're not one of them. We would say, get him in here right now. When it comes to, you know, stuff that is truly critical and intensive care is necessary, of course, our goal is to stabilize the patient and then send them to, you know, the overnight emergency and critical care facility for constant monitoring, intensive care hospitalization. We will have for an unstable patient if we have to, but we're generally strongly recommending getting them where they're most appropriately going to be treated and monitored. The most common reason we're going to keep them in-house and do the best we can for them with, you know, a non-24-hour facility, the reason we'll do that from time to time is because some people simply can't afford the cost of the after-hours care. After-hours care can be very, very expensive, sometimes double, triple the cost of what they'll pay in our hospital. And some folks, let's face it, just can't handle it. So they'll take their chances in a facility that's not open 24 hours. And very often things still go well. We're always very clear, less than ideal. 5 p.m. comes around, and that's typically when we're closed, except for one day a week. One day a week, I am open until 8, and that's a Tuesday. Reason being is a lot of people work from 9 to 5, and, you know, that evening is the only time they can realistically bring in their pets. So Tuesday nights are pretty popular, and that's the one night of the week I am open. But pretty much we're closed at 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. So 5 p.m. to after hours, just because we close at 5 p.m. doesn't mean we're actually going home. And there are those cases, like I said, that are critical. Since we do see emergencies cases, sometimes to get the patient stable and get them on their way to the emergency clinic takes time. And as a result, you know, we're often there well past 5 p.m., but our goal is to try to leave by, you know, 5:30, 6 o'clock. Not always going to be the case. Sometimes if I'm trying to, if a patient needs an emergency surgery, and that happens quite often, you know, hit by a car comes in, needs to be surgically addressed, a number of different conditions occur that require surgery. You know, I will stay to do it. I, of course, you know, you don't want to do surgery on a patient and then, you know, leave for the night. But at the same token, we're not 24 hours. We don't have cots. So I am trying to get those cases to go to the emergency critical care center. Sometimes I'll do the surgery to save some costs and then say, okay, let the aftercare be there if they're transferable. But for the most part, you know, if the affordability just isn't there, it's not there. And so some of these patients will, you know, will be there till 8, 9 o'clock because we've done the surgery. We want to sit with them for as long as possible to make sure that they are stable or stable as they can be before they leave for the night. So after hours can be a busy time. And then lastly, before we leave, we're going to do evening rounds. And evening rounds are much like morning rounds. We're going to wrap up the day. We're going to recommend treatment protocols. The technicians have gone over all the animals. They've given us all the vital statistics. And based on that information, we're going to make our recommendations for treatment, overnight fluid therapy, parameters that we want them to follow, and what we're going to do in the morning and what to expect. So more evening rounds are just as important as morning rounds. It gives the doctors the information they need to know what exactly is the status of their patients, both the surgical patients as well as the ones that are hospitalized, and enables us to communicate with technicians exactly what we want them to do. We write up the orders, and they get done. And then, finally, we go home, get some sleep, and do it again the next morning. So that's a day in the life of a veterinarian. My last email question, got a kind of boogie here. I only have 2.5 minutes. This is Erica from Lake Mary, Florida. I'm so glad I found such a good resource right here in Florida. My veterinarian insists that I vaccinate my cat every year for feline leukemia, even though my cat is strictly indoors. It is my understanding that cats cannot get infected with that disease by airborne infection. I'm a person that tends to trust and listen to doctors, but I have heard and read so much about this, I feel like he's wanting me to unnecessarily vaccinate my cat. Your opinion would be most appreciated. Okay, so feline leukemia is a retroviral disease in the family of HIV, of course not contagious to people, but the reason that's significant is because we know HIV does not transmit by casual contact, fluid transfer, copulation, bite wounds, blood transfusions. You need intimate fluid exchange is the bottom line. The same goes for feline leukemia and FIV in cats. That stated, even if I know I have an indoor cat patient, we know some cats are escape artists, and if they get out, we don't want them to have a naive system. So for that reason, as kittens, I will typically start them, whether they're indoor or outdoor, on the feline leukemia protocol so that they have some of that cell-mediated immunity, some level of protection in case they escape. They don't have a completely naive immune system. So I will go through the kitten series with feline leukemia. However, if I have a consistently indoor cat and an apartment cat at that, apartment cats tend to be more strictly indoors because they don't quite have the same opportunity to run out a ripped screen or let out by a child necessarily. If they get out, they're going to end up in a hallway most of the time. So in the case of an apartment cat, I would not be vaccinating yearly for feline leukemia. And I wouldn't even for a house cat that's kept strictly indoors. If the owner is reporting to me that the cat consistently is an escape artist and then gets out all the time, yes, I'm going to vaccinate for feline leukemia. But for the most part, I'm going to get them through the kitten series, and beyond that, going to stop unless their lifestyle changes. So hope that helps you out, Erica, and I'm so glad you enjoy the show. The Space Coast is actually not very far from Lake Mary, only about an hour and 15-minute drive, I believe. That wraps up our show for this evening. Thank you very much for tuning in and give you a little bit of idea of what my life is like, and I'm looking forward to getting some of the feedback on this. Have a great night, everybody. Thanks again for tuning in.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.